Russia warns Trump, do not escalate the war. The United States, in their response, almost says, what escalation? What war are you talking about? We're not really clear what our plan actually is. We seem to acknowledge that there are some things going on in the war. Some of our actions are not actually working, and we don't seem to have a plan to what happens after that. Meanwhile, Russia does seem to have a plan on what it wants to happen on the front line. To try to analyze all this stuff and figure out what in the world is going on, we have with us for the first time today, Bill Buppert, who's a former U.S. Army officer, military analyst, and historian. Bill, welcome to the show. A lot of people have been asking for you on our show in the past. If you can hear me. Can you hear me, Bill? All right, well, that's not the way we were looking to start. Bill, can you hear me? Can you hear me?
I apologize. I'm having some technical difficulties again where I can't hear you, Dan. For some reason, I went live.
That's really not helpful. We had it just a second ago, but we seem to have some issues here. Gary, anything you can do or recommend?
Well, I'll work with them offline, Dan. You can go ahead and go with the show.
All right. We'll figure it out. We'll continue on this, and as soon as we can get Bill online, we'll get that. But listen, there's been some really strange issues going on. We'll get to this in a minute, but Sergey Lavrov was given some warnings about some nuclear claims from some American guy who's going to be interviewed and interrogated, as Lavrov put it, before the Senate Armed Services Committee on a potential new Assistant Secretary of Defense, who was specifically for nuclear issues. And some of the answers didn't leave things in a very good sense with Russia. They made some comments on that. But even before that, of course, we've been talking here about what's going on with the Pokrovsk area, what's going on in Kupiansk, what's going on in Zaporizhia, what's going on in the Kharkiv, what's going on in the air inside of Ukraine, knocking out electricity. All those kinds of things are happening everywhere. Ukraine's having a hard time even forced mobilizing, forced stealing people, press ganging off the streets, desertions leaving once they actually get them on there. All these things are showing that the front line is crumbling and the strategic situation is falling apart for Ukraine. You would not know that, however, from listening to our Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who was asked, by the way, this is just yesterday, he was asked at a reporter, Do you think Russia even wants peace?
Secretary, is it your assessment that Russia does not really want peace?
Well, we can only go by what we see. I mean, I think they've stated clearly what they want is they want the rest of Donetsk. And obviously the Ukrainians aren't going to agree to that. So what we see now is they continue long-range strikes into Ukraine, obviously to degrade their electrical grid and try to demoralize the country or what have you. And you know, they've made some gains in Donetsk, and they're losing 7,000 soldiers a week, 7,000 dead soldiers a week from Russia's side. So as of now, I mean, that's the assessment we have to make. They've made a demand that Ukraine can't agree to, and so we're sort of where we are at this point.
You didn't have any deliverables to bring from Washington on the Ukraine issue, is that correct, or did you?
Well, I mean, the president's done the sanctions, which was what they asked him to do, so that happened very recently. But as far as deliverables, we continue to do what we've been doing. Plus, we know the new sanctions.
You know, it's just not a good look when the Secretary of State does a lot of this, just arm shrugging. And I don't know. I mean, I guess we do. I guess we have deliverables, which one of the questions he was asked there. I mean, we did some sanctions. What is abundantly clear from this exchange here? I mean, it is just one exchange, but it is incredibly telling in light of even the questions that were asked. We don't know. We have no plan. What we're doing doesn't make any sense at all. Bill, do I have you there? Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Okay, yes, we are rocking and rolling there. Good to have you. And by the way, just kind of welcome to the show. It's the first time we've had you on. We've had a lot of people been asking about you, and you apparently have a pretty good little following. So welcome to the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.
It is an honor to be here, Dan, and I have listened to your videos over the past few years and really enjoyed them, because I find that your well-informed military views are a bit unorthodox and a bit anti-war. And I say that in a realist sense. So I really appreciate what you've been doing.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. Although I always say I do not consider myself anti-war at all. I consider myself anti-stupid war and unnecessary war. And I am vociferously against that. And so if people want to call it that, it doesn't matter as long as it's based on reality. And that certainly is where we are a little off kilter right here. And in fact, even before we get into that, I wonder if just for any of our audience that may not be familiar with you, if you can just kind of tell us a little bit about who you are and what your background is.
I will. So I'm formerly in, I was enlisted in the Navy, got out, went to college, got my commission in the U.S. Army to avoid sea duty, and found that, well, I won't deploy. Well, that turns out, as you know, Dan, not to be the case, and I deployed everywhere. I retired in 2003, spent 4 years to get the lead out, and then I became a contractor doing various things to include two contract tours in 2013 and 15 in Afghanistan, the first of which I spent in Kabul, the second of which I spent in Mazar-e-Sharif, which was a German-Dutch army base near the Uzbeki border, where I was training 5th and 10th Special Forces and Commandos Kandax, which is Afghan for battalions. And that's where ANASOC was, the Afghan National Army Special Operations Command. That's what I was doing. I got an offer, Dan, that I couldn't refuse, where I was able to come home and make some good coin and not deploy anymore. And my wife was grateful. Since that time, I've written on liberty. I've written on war. As you know from speaking to Scott Horton, I am his Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs at the Libertarian Institute. And I think you guys may have been discussing the Scott Horton Academy and the new...
We have.
So the new course that I put together for him, I have other courses in mind too, is called Trail of Tears, American Military Stalemate and Defeat Since 1945, where I spent almost 9 hours discussing since that time this historical trail of tears, this cavalcade of calamities that has been American military engagement around the world. I also do the Chasing Ghosts podcast, in which I talk about irregular warfare. And I did a companion to that called War Notes, a conventional podcast, so that I could tackle more conventional stuff when it came to that. So I think I'm on my 95th episode, something like that.
Very good. We'll certainly point people toward that back at the end. Thank you. But let's jump on this issue right here because,
yes,
man, it's hard to imagine. By the way, let me ask, did you see that clip of Marco Rubio I just played?
I did.
Okay, terrific. Because it is astounding to me that we're now closing in on the 4-year mark of this war. And to stand there and say, I don't know, we did some sanctions, I guess, and it doesn't look like Russia wants to have a peace. Well, of course, Russia has never left the peace table, but the terms, however, that they want are radically different from anything that the West is wanting, and we seem to have no plan to reconcile the two sides. So what do you say to that situation at the 4-year mark?
So I think at the 4-year mark, we've learned so much. In 2020, and you're a savvy military conflict observer as I am, in 2020, you could not have convinced me that in 2025, 80% of all casualties in the Russia-Ukraine war would be due to UAVs, UAS, and FPVs. As a matter of fact, Dan, and you probably know this already, there is a new service in Russia that has been commissioned, which is devoted entirely to unmanned aircraft warfare. Now, I suspect they're going to use those unmanned modalities to go from mud to space, maybe even seafloor to space, where they'll have the service devoted to that. I'm not surprised by this because there is such a almost a prejudicial tilt in the Department of State and the DOD to look at the Russians as knuckle draggers and to look at this conflict as one that is not complicated by good and evil on both sides, but that only one side, the Ukraine, is good, and only the other side, Russia, is evil. And that's a framing that's rather naive and immature.
but not to mention inaccurate, because
amen.
Especially, amen. And we won't get into the detail too much here, but there has been some profound corruption in Ukraine from the outset of this, but it's just now burst into the open here with one of Zelensky's right-hand man, and he's trying to deal with that. But that's just the latest thing that's popped out. But I want to look at one of the other things I think that's enduring misinformation, self-misinformation on our own part, and that is this claim that not only is Russia always evil and always knuckle-dragon, but they're also always dying in large numbers. He mentioned there that, oh, yeah, Russia's losing 7,000 dead a week, 1,000 per day dead.
No, they're not.
Claiming.
No, they're not.
But my point being, and I had previously said, well, they obviously don't believe that. They're just saying it for public consumption. But I have been told by two completely separate sources, very well connected to the U.S. government, that says, no, in fact, they do believe that because they're being told that at the highest levels by the U.S. intelligence community, who has their own motivation. This is astounding. We are being misinformed at our own hands inside the government. Yes. What do you say to that?
So I've got a couple observations that may sound unconventional. I apologize if you or your audience don't agree with them. Number one, I refer to the I'm not a member of either party, but I refer to the DNC as the DNC CPUSA, because clearly that is the way they behaved. Why do the Democrats have a hard-on for Russia? It's because fundamentally and institutionally, the Russians abandoned the communist project in 1991, and they will never forgive them. The second thing I want to bring up is that whether we like this framing or not, ever since the creation of the American intelligence community, starting with the CIA and the Devil's Chessboard in 1947 and 1948, the Democrats have been the public face of the American intelligence community. And I know that's a bit counterintuitive for some observers, but it clearly plays out. And in November 1963, a lesson was taught to the American people.
November 22nd, I would wager.
Yeah, a lesson was taught that please do not try to mess with the American intelligence community and the concomitant color revolutions and the way through covert action and clandestine action they have been trying to reform the world in a way that is advantageous not to America, but to the American deep state.
And I'm sorry, for those who may not know, November 22nd, 1963 was when John F. Kennedy was assassinated.
It is.
Many believe by at least participation of the CIA.
Indeed. And now again, speculative. I don't have the evidence, and I'm not one of those Kennedy assassination obsessors where I spend a disproportionate amount of my time researching that. But when I examine it from the perspective that you and I would approach that, which is looking at it from an intelligence and an information perspective, you ask yourself, cui bono, who benefits? Well, obviously, the American deep state, the American intelligence community, and all of these color revolutions that we have seen since that time have been such, sorry about that, that all of these intelligence organizations have been invested in using, USAID was removed as a cutout and things like that, have been invested in using this as a way to reform the surface of planet Earth since 1991.
Yeah, I mean, you really can't get around that. Lots of information out there that just doesn't line up. But the bottom line, the impression for sure inside the U.S. government has been a lot of times that is how powerful the CIA, and there's a lot of people that are, quite frankly, afraid to counter it. And maybe some of that fear is not unfounded. Getting back to what Rubio said there, one of the other problems is, and this is with the West writ large, not even just the U.S. administration, in that they keep saying over and over, we want these sanctions, these 19 rounds of sanctions, the Trump sanctions that he has done, and then now then the round number 20 that they're getting ready to get done. They keep saying in the West, this is all to, quote, pressure Putin into coming to the table. Well, as I said a minute ago, Russia's at the table. They've actually never left the table. But the big disconnect is in that Russia is requiring an ugly peace, an ugly term from the Ukrainian perspective, or they're saying, or we'll simply keep fighting. Do you see that there will ever be a time when the West can acknowledge that if we don't accept this ugly deal, we're going to end up getting an even uglier military defeat? Is that even in the mindset?
So I don't think it's in the martial imagination of that curious building that's shaped funny. on the Potomac. And I just don't think that we have the strength of character nor the commitment to truth in the West to acknowledge what has happened with Russia and why they've realigned themselves the way they have. Because I think for the most part, and again, what surprises me is that why hasn't the Department of State had a very expensive office and conference room available with expensive teak tables and administrative staff, seasoned diplomats waiting there, maybe even, you know, rolling their thumbs about, waiting for the Ukrainians and the Russians to come in and talk? Because during wartime, it is never bad to talk. It is never bad to have either overt channels or back channels. I would think that the back channels would be there. We have a history of employing back channels. Between January and August 1945, there were Japanese back channels to the United States where they were discussing why unconditional surrender was something they couldn't accept, why eventually Truman did relent and say, we are going to give you the emperor. There's nothing wrong with talking during conflict. And I'm really surprised at how, again, naive and immature the diplomatic initiatives have been from the West. Now, we can't leave the British out of this because the British may be patient zero as the bad guys for this entire episode in the Ukraine, and the U.S. went along with this. This could have been solved in the first year if only negotiations had happened in a realistic manner. We approached it by looking at the Ukraine in a realistic manner. The Ukraine is the primary money laundering modality in the West since the 1980s. I mean, when you look at 1980s. What, go ahead, please.
No, I said, well, I'm just saying since the 1980s, that's not just since 2024 or 2022 or even 2014, but you're going even further back than that.
I'm doing that because they've always been an odd man out in the Russian sphere, as evidenced by behavior in the last decades, if not generations, in that in 1990-91, once the wall fell and all the Stan brothers calved off from the bottom of Russia proper, the USSR no longer being what it was, shrinking to what it appeared, all of a sudden, going into the 1990s, and then we look at 2004, 2008, the Maiden Revolution in 2014, the money laundering that occurred in that place. I'm waiting for the revelations to come out with the receipts of just how bad it was. But I think that U.S. aid, for instance, using the CIA and other intelligence organizations, using that to avoid findings being those presidential permission slips that the CIA uses for its covert operations overseas, its color revolutions, things like that. They used USAID and other entities as a cutout to avoid those findings and even giving the deniability to the various administrations that have been in charge that entire time. But I also think I want to go back very briefly to 1947 to 1949 and the formation of the CIA. Two things occurred. Number one, they wanted a unified and united intelligence entity that would gather intelligence and provide for decision makers the single most accurate picture of what was going on at the ground at these various countries or interstate conflicts that we were involved with. But number two, and worse yet, I mentioned the devil's chessboard, Dulles wanted covert action. He wanted all that sexy James Bond kind of stuff, the paramilitary, the military, where we would actually go overseas and even in concert with color revolutions, sponsor military coups, 1953 in Iran. We know what happened there. And then you could go on and on, again, a trail of tears, where when you look at these dark and shadowy color revolutions and covert actions that occurred over time, none of them really end well. I'm not going to cuss on your program because I didn't get a permission slip for that.
I appreciate that.
But I always like to say that Newton's third law is a stone cold motherfracker. I mean, it always comes around. And if you don't plan for that, if you don't, in what you and I as military guys would call the contingencies, those kind of things that may occur after the conflict is either over or in the middle of it, where all of a sudden the friction and fog comes in, that Clausewitzian bugbear, where our plans, and we have to plan, I get that. Eisenhower talked about that. But those plans will go awry. Make plans for what's going to happen if things go awry. And I always get the sense, Dan, that those plans are not in place. When I look at this 21st century series of wars that we've been in, to include the ones that Obama created in Libya, Yemen, and Syria, no substantive plans were made for what happens if those things go awry.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we've talked about that a lot too, and that really is on display, I think, profoundly in the effort at hand right here, and that is in that same conversation with Marco Rubio, to give evidence of the fact that they haven't thought about what comes next. What if Plan A doesn't work? He was asked about the issue of the Russian attack on the Ukrainian energy system.
We've had those conversations with the Ukrainians about what they need, and I know that's ongoing. And, you know, clearly helping them survive the winter is important just from on a humanitarian ground. The challenge is that Ukraine's energy grid has been diminished each year. So each year they start at a lower baseline than the year before. Now, I think in Kyiv, for example, upwards of 50 to 60% of the day is spent without electrical power. And they've done a tremendous job of sort of rerouting their grid and trying to work around it. But that also means there are hours of the day where you can't, there's no water, there's no electricity. You have to schedule business and life activities around that. And that's clearly part of Russia's strategy, is to try to collapse morale within Ukraine and the will to fight. So, you know, that's why we've been in discussions with them about defensive weapons to be able to protect their grid. And I know we've been in ongoing technical conversations about the specific equipment they need. But ultimately, if that equipment is ultimately destroyed a week later after it's installed, that remains a problem. And that's been the history of the last.
wait, that last part. Hang on. You're saying that we're in talks, again, nearly at the completion of the four-year mark, for something to help them defend their grid, which you also acknowledge has been degraded year after year, getting worse. And then you acknowledge that what we have given them is destroyed like a week later. So in that regard, why in the hell would you want to keep doing what is clearly not working?
It what astonishes me, and I wanted to get your insight on this, Dan, if I may, is that any tanks, for instance, I think the era of the man tank is over. I think the era of the A-10 and the Frogfoot, the Su-25, is over. I think the era of manned combat aircraft is over. We're late to the game in seeing that. But any tanks, for instance, that were sent, Leopards, Challengers, Abrams, that were sent to the eastern third of the Ukraine, would be scrapped in 72 hours. Because the Russian strike fire reconnaissance complex, I will tell you, is the most lethal fire synchronization system that any peer combatant has on planet Earth now, in that we have nothing close to it in the American armed forces by any stretch, whether that's a single service or through joint fires. And I'm also astonished, Dan, and this is where I want to get your insight. How could it be wise for us to take IAMD, as Integrated Air Missile Defense, which would be effectors and sensors? How is it wise to take Patriots, THAADs, and all these other very sophisticated and expensive Singleton missile systems that we have, and bring them over there and use them and see them knocked out consistently and playing chess with the Russians? Whatever you think of them, they're sophisticated note takers. They're sophisticated about their AARs, their after action reports. They're sophisticated in observing things and sort of rewiring or recoding how they do their business and how they conduct their business. What we've given them is we've taken all of our best and most pristine peer sensors and effectors, in this case, missiles, if we're just speaking to that. And we've shown them how they work. We've shown them what the what the shortfalls are, what the advantages are that we have, what the disadvantages are. I am convinced, for instance, again, I don't have evidence to support this. This is sheer speculation. When the Iranians hit the Israelis, I think it was last year with the first missile barrage, I think the Iranian generals and supervisors went to all of their ammunition supply points that held their palletized missiles and said, I need your oldest lot numbers because I don't need anything to hit Israeli soil. This will be a reconnaissance by fire so that we will lob missiles into Israel proper over major cities We're going to sit back, surveil, and take notes on what their reaction times are, what they're employing, what their kinetic magazine structure is, how they're resupplying, all of that. I'm convinced that the Iranians did that. I'm also convinced that the Russians do the very same thing. But I wanted to get your insight on what you think about America taking all of its pristine and very august, exquisite platforms and showing the Russians how they work.
Yeah, no, I've actually made comment on that many times over the year that that was a big disaster because we've literally just given them a laboratory with all of the relevant conditions necessary for them to figure out how to either distract, defeat, or mitigate the effects of it. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of that. Big fan of that observation. I'm not a big fan of the fact that we've done it. In fact, I thought it was a big disaster. But it also shows the weakness in our mentality because we aren't mentally prepared for the rapidity with which you have to think and react and change and adjust in modern combat. We're back still in 1991 when I went to Desert Storm, or maybe 2003 in Iraq, going to Baghdad and all that kind of stuff, where the enemy doesn't have that kind of ability. And we just continued on. Gary, all of a sudden I'm getting a really bad echo. Can you do anything with that? I'm not sure what happened. But Gary, also, do you have that fog video? Okay. You mentioned something about tanks. I do have a view on that. I don't think that they have gone the way of the dinosaur. I just think they have changed. And okay, very good. I got that. So, and I'd like your view on this here. But what I have seen and talked to many Russians just recently, actually, is that they say, no, the tanks are still there. They're still out there. They're still helpful. But now that they're basically relegated to fire support capability to try to go into these barricades that the enemy has, et cetera, and they can be used to support other things like this. But this is what they're using in the main areas. Where it's like, look, it's just trucks sometimes, it's motorcycles, it's whatever works with all the sensors and things that are out there. So there's still a combination of things, but this is actually what I meant a minute ago with the mentality. You've got to have the flexibility of mind to be able to say, well, if this thing doesn't work, if this stuff we planned on doesn't work, we got to figure out what will. And if that's just a freaking truck and a car with no doors, then so be it. If it's a motorcycle, if it's small groups of two and three, we'll do what it takes to succeed. And I don't know that we're as nimble of mind as that. What do you think?
Oh man, we are not nimble. I mean, I'm fond of saying, Dan, that we have the finest and most expensive 20th century pure combat military on Earth that is not fit for purpose for 21st century pure combat. Not only in the first quarter century of this new millennium have we had tremendous difficulty fighting irregular warfare, which is my specialty from a military conflict perspective, but even when we look at what we have available to us to conduct pure combat in this century, you can look at aircraft carriers, which I really have a bone in my teeth about, because I think that all they are is future fish apartments, and we need to get rid of them and decommission them tomorrow morning if possible. But you look at tanks, you look at aircraft, you look at our ICBMs, our IRBMs. There is not a single weapon system that we have, apart from our leg infantry and mechanized infantry modalities, the Bradley being accepted, because I think that's a tremendous hunk of junk. But nonetheless, we spend so much money on the most expensive military paper tiger in the history of wars on Earth, and here we are. I mean, we're in a terrible way spending nearly $1 trillion a year if you include the DOE cutouts for nuclear weapons and things like that. $1 trillion a year. I don't think we're getting a return on investment, Dan.
Oh, I definitely don't either. We voiced concerns on that on this channel quite a bit. I also want to run back here to the Middle East, because we've painted a picture here where the U.S. administration is just completely disenfranchised from the reality. We just don't seem to recognize it, and we're still going on trying to just make whatever we wanted to do work inside. We're not the only ones, unfortunately, on our side of the ledger. And we're going to go not just to the administration, but in a minute, going to go to the U.S. Senate, which is going to have some special place in the Hall of Shame. But first of all, let's go to one of the senior guys in the Hall of Shame, Volodymyr Zelensky.
Good American afternoon and evening in Spain. Or you have morning.
America morning.
We're morning.
Good morning. We are thankful for your bipartisan support. We are thankful, United States, your nation. We are thankful to President Trump and for some initiatives which we will discuss today. And thank you so much for all this period that you are with us. And of course, we are thankful for last sanctions package of President. It was important for us about energy, Russian energy, and I hope it will work, and I hope it will give us a really possibility, instrument for pressure on Russia.
So he is all smiles, no matter how bad things, and I just talked to you at the opening of this about how bad things are on the front line, how bad things are in the air. Rubio himself talked about they're lucky if they get 50% of the time they even have electricity, gas, running water, etc. That's how bad things are. And yet he's all smiles about, yay, I'm going to get another package from the United States. What do you make of that?
So I think it's part of money laundering. I am convinced that kompromat, which is a Russian term for compromised material on people, that the West has used that for not only a lot of maybe its domestic politicos, and the evidence is out there if one would dig around. But when it comes to foreign entities that are friendly or neutral to the United States, in this case, the Ukraine, Zelensky, I mean, here's a guy who a mere 10 years ago was playing a piano with his penis. I mean, this is a man... I'm sorry to be crude when I say that, but this is a man who is not up to the task. He's playing at this, but then again, there's a certain thespian component to being a politician, and I get that. Winston Churchill would be a great example of that, a great exemplar of that. But making these kind of friends and allies are ones that we can do without. But then I also view this, Dan, from a non-interventionist lens, not an isolationist lens, but non-interventionist, because I want to have commerce with the world. I simply don't want to export violence abroad when I don't have to. But I just find we make friends with the worst people. I mean, did we not just have a meeting with a head chopper in the awful office? I call it the awful, which is OFFAL or AWFUL, however you select it. We just had a Syrian head chopper who was a member of Al-Qaeda come, and he's greeted to much fanfare in the awful office. We choose the worst people. We have had a relationship with Al-Qaeda, again, I alluded to it earlier, since the 1980s. We helped form Al-Qaeda. It was Congressman Wilson who started arming the Mujahideen with Stinger missiles and things like that. It helped to establish Al-Qaeda. And then in the 1990s, of course, Al-Qaeda starts to turn around. But then again, we can fast forward to Libya. Everybody is familiar with Benghazi. What was the ambassador doing? He was going there either to retrieve Stinger missiles or to give munitions to AQ affiliates in the area. We aligned ourselves with AQ affiliates in Syria. And to a certain extent, ISIS was a creation of bad intelligence activities by the CIA and other bad actors there. So I'm always aghast at who we make friends with overseas.
And is there any kind of an end to this? I mean, I guess there eventually will be. I mean, I remember, maybe you can talk a little bit about this if you have studied this, back during the Vietnam War, when we were really good friends with the president of South Vietnam until we weren't. And then we kind of either turned a blind eye, or some say we even helped a coup that ended up having him killed. And then somebody else stepped in there. So how does that kind of transition happen? And do you see any possibility of that in this case?
I certainly do. I mean, can Zelensky be assassinated tomorrow morning? I happen to think the Russians have not done that because he's such a convenient stooge for them, because I think the Russians are very savvy when it comes to external espionage, human intelligence, and that kind of thing. The possibility is certainly there, but who's waiting in the wings to take his place? Another bad actor. I mean, I am hard-pressed to look at allies that we've had since the end of World War II in August 1945 who are not only not so credible partners of the United States, but have not been manipulated by the United States for what the deep state and the intelligence community thinks is best for us. And unfortunately, I think, Dan, that for the most part, I was amused by what you said about anti-war and rational war. We can tease that out some other time, but
yeah.
War is the business of America since 1871. In 1871, there was a failed coup attempt by the Americans in Korea. Didn't go so well. Came back home. And then in the 1880s, we take over the Hawaiian Islands. Then the 1890s, Spanish-American War. All of a sudden, we find ourselves with colonial possessions in the Pacific and in the Caribbean. Fast forward to 1914. Wilson gets in. He promises, oh, no, America won't get involved in another European war. Well, he gets involved in it. As a result of 1917 and 1918, I'm amused by this time cop story where a time cop goes back. And Dan, let's suppose you send me back in time and you say, I need you to murder Adolf Hitler as a baby, as a child, whatever the case may be. I return and you say, how did it go? And I say, you know, Chief, I didn't get that guy, but I did manage to murder Woodrow Wilson. But I didn't get to Adolf Hitler. And you go, Adolf who? Because Wilson was patient zero for Adolf Hitler. Mm. Adolf Hitler is patient zero for World War II. World War II is patient zero for decolonization and the deracinization, the decomposition of the European colonial complex, whether it's Portugal, France, England, and all the others with their holdings in Africa and Asia. And all of a sudden, all of these intrastate wars, civil wars, and interstate wars start to really multiply around the world because they have been released and loosed from their colonial tethers to start doing that. Because one of my watchwords is that when I observe conflict history, and I know you're a reader of military history just like me, is that civil wars usually erupt as a result of larger wars that have been there that breathe oxygen into the embers of long dormant conflict. World War I did that, World War II did that, and of course World War II led directly to French invasions of Indochina and Algeria, which was considered a part of metropolitan France. Of course, we inherit that in Vietnam. But when you look at America, and I cover this in detail in Trail of Tears, that course that I did for Scott, is that we haven't won a military conflict since 1945. And some will say, well, what about the Brilliant Campaign in 1991 and the Gulf War? Well, if that had been won, we wouldn't have returned in 2003 now, would we? But mind you, I want to put this little observation that I liked the fact that in that war it had very limited mission objectives,
yeah.
And we simply stopped. I thought it was so sober the way the Persian Gulf War was conducted, even though I think its origins were urged on, like what Ambassador Glaspie did when she sort of gave a wink and a nod to the Iraqis to invade Kuwait. And Scott Horton talks about that in great detail. But then we fast forward now, there's no conflict that American armed forces, whether in a regular or conventional conflict, has won. Recently, if we fast forward now to what's happening off of Yemen, not only have we lost over 24 Predators, which are very large and expensive UASs by the Yemenis, which arguably is a third world country, but they have run those aircraft carriers out of those narrow bottoms of the Red Sea because they're running scared. Even though I've never been a carrier admiral, nor do I play one on TV. You would never find me bringing a carrier into a narrow seascape like the Red Sea. I don't understand why we do that, but there it is. But so when you look at between 1945 and 2025, you ask yourself, we've been spending trillions of dollars on this enormous military complex festooned with exquisite platforms, and we always come up with zero when it comes to stalemate, when it comes to victory. We don't.
When it comes to victory, when it comes to positive outcomes, but man, does it keep the gravy train rolling. And that,
I have three sons, two daughters, and seven grandchildren, and I just discovered yesterday my eighth grandchild is on the way. when I was in Afghanistan, my sons would ask me, hey, Dad, so what are you doing over there? I tell them what I was doing. And they say, so when you look at the war overall, what do you think? And I say, it's a very sophisticated money laundering operation for the military industrial complex.
Hard to argue with the assessment there, but we'll have to leave it there for the time being. Listen, we really appreciate you coming on, and glad we got some of our technical issues solved, and look forward to having you back on next Zoom, because there's a lot of things we need to keep talking about there. And I look forward to getting into some of that stuff with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dan. It was an honor to be on your show, and I love what you do, and keep doing what you do.
Thank you very much. And we'll keep doing it with you. But in the meantime, we're going to move right on next to Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst, coming up literally in just 7 or 8 minutes from now at noon. He's going to be coming to us actually from not far from where I am right now, elsewhere here in the D.C. area. He's going to be getting on a plane later on, but he has graciously decided and allowed us to have a show with him from his hotel suite is where I believe he's going to be coming from. You're not going to want to miss some of the stuff he's got to say. And I actually had dinner with him last night. Looking forward to talk to you about that coming up soon in about 7 minutes from now. Larry Johnson on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. See you in a minute.